This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming, all of you. And thanks to Don, to Arthur, and to Madeline, and to Arakawa for being here. What we want to do tonight is not really a discussion, is not really an event, is not really an opening. It's a bit of all of these together, since we want to contextualize what we've done and what can be done next. And this is an element that I think all of you have stressed in your work. What has been done can be seen, can be archived, but what to do next? And I'd say that here, something that connects most of us is a certain reference to Duchamp's work and to the impact of Duchamp and what that has meant. And this is actually how we at Slot started gathering and working together, being by chance all in Philadelphia, where the Duchamp collection can be seen. And we know that Arakawa had this intimate personal link with Duchamp as a young creator, artist, and thinker. What we'd like to do tonight is, via Duchamp, ask a number of questions. One of these questions, I think, has been systematized for many years by Don Eide in his many books on phenomenology, the phenomenology of techné or technology. And I think this is one question that I have for all of us. Can we still speak of art in the usual sense when we think through the concepts of techné, which is often translated as art, but is also on the side of technology? As Don has argued in many books, following insights of Heidegger, it is quite likely that techné and technology is more essential than science. So that links leads to another question, which is the question of the sciences and what sciences do we use and how can today's artist become a scientist and what kind of interdisciplinary knowledge does he need to bring to bear to his practice. And starting from Arthur Danto's reflection on the end of art, after the end of art and after the end of art, today's artists tend to be non-artists, in a sense. They do other things. But it can also be called art at times. It can be shown or not shown. And that's the last question. Does it have to be shown, that I would ask all of you?
Well, I'm not afraid to start. Actually, one of my big interests across the disciplines has been the role of embodiment and the fact that any kind of action into which humans engage implies some kind of bodily action. This is one of the things that drew me to Arakawa and Ginn's work, because clearly one of the really strong theses of the art and the architecture that they have done is a very strong statement of how humans relate to their environments in terms of bodily action, not simply in terms of, let's say, conceptuality or other kinds of more abstract activity. So a couple of years ago in Paris, when we had a conference on their work, I went through that work historically and tried to show how increasingly their art and architecture exemplified this interaction of bodies, embodiment, with the surround, what they ultimately call an architectural surround, etc. Now, this starts out with a kind of multi-stable look at things in the early drawings, tubes, etc., etc. But then the series of paintings which are supposed to be seen with the eyes closed, in which you have a ramp, and the viewer has to walk up the ramp and stand in a state of disequilibrium with eyes closed, you can imagine what this does. It engages one's body in a very disturbing and shocking sort of way. And then if you jump, of course, to the architecture that they are producing, all of the various different heights and perspectives which are engaged in this architecture calls for the coming into awareness of one's embodiment. Now, I don't want to take up too much time with this initial statement, but if you contrast that to scientific investigations, and I've been working for more than a decade now on imaging technologies, and contend that the 20th century actually brings about a second scientific revolution, which is at least as important as the first scientific revolution of the 17th century, and largely it occurs through imaging technologies. Here the sense of embodiment is very, very different, because one of the things that imaging technologies do only in the 20th century is to get beyond any kind of normal perceptual experience that we humans have. For example, all astronomy up until the 20th century was restricted to the optical part of the microwave spectrum through telescopes, et cetera, which were introduced in modern science. But now that we have radio astronomy discovered by accident, gamma ray, X-ray astronomy, et cetera, all of this images emissions which are beyond anything that we can directly experience. But precisely because of that, it implies a body. It has to be translated back into that which we can perceive as visual gestalts, pulsars casting out their radiation waves, etc., etc. So we now have a sort of second stage of embodiment, which is, I would say, in fairly vast contrast with the Arakawa and Gin's direct engagement, which we have. I've sometimes hinted that my biggest criticism of their architecture is I'm not quite sure where I can rest in this architecture. It is constantly calling me to be active, and sometimes I just want to lie down and curl up and take a nap.
Do you want to say something to that? Can one rest in your... I think one can, no?
I'd like to hear what Arthur has to say, and then we'll see. Yeah.
What does that matter?
I'd like to hear what you have to say after... and after that, Arkana
after
would
what
like...
After what Dan yes. says?
Mm-hmm. Or in general, in Arthur, Danto yeah. land.
Well, I suppose that I can see our architecture in terms of a certain range of human actions. That is to say, you've got to be able to get in, you've got to be able to look out. There are various kinds of things. It wouldn't be much of a house if there weren't a door, if there weren't some windows. The floor has got to be able to sustain a body without falling through it. You can go on in that way, but I don't know what kind of an agenda that recommends to anybody. That is to say, any place we are has got that already. It seems like the problems, the essential problems of architecture have been solved immemorially. That's to say that we have some idea of what a shelter is. It protects us from the elements. So what more is it that you want from architecture than that? There are certain things that we have no real need for, it seems to me. Nobody needs a room 1,000 feet high, for example. It's wasted space. There's no particular advantage in having a room that high. The height of a room in relationship to the human body is something that you factor in when you know what the function of the room is. But again, I don't quite know what beyond that is interesting to say about architecture. So and the body. So I'd like to hear a little bit more about what you've got in mind by embodiment than that.
All right, that's a very useful question that leads me to say that. We want to privilege procedures. To privilege procedures within the spaces that we construct. We humbly almost don't allow ourselves the word architecture, but then we're often roped into it. But it's not our first choice of word. Our first choice of word for that actually was biosclave configurature, which is the configuring of the biosclave. We prefer to speak of what other people refer to as biosphere, as biosclave. Remember, Arthur, years ago when we were working on blank, we spoke about cleaving and wanting to indicate the two different types of cleaving. We want biosclave to give a sense of the dynamics at play. And this is a convenient way to do that. Biosphere closes it down, it's a word. Biosclave opens it up and gives a set of dynamics. But we can call it architecture too. It's biosclave configurature, which it took us a month to learn how to pronounce that word. And then we semi-dropped it and we can speak of architecture. And we want to privilege procedures, and the procedures we speak of are architectural procedures. And an architectural procedure is a clunky, clumsy term that is incredibly useful as far as we're concerned. As a matter of fact, our intention, as you know, is to try to reverse the downhill course of human life. Yes. And architectural procedures we consider to be key to this, and I will explain why. But Arkad, do you want to say something before I continue? All right.
Well, I knew sooner or later it would come round to that.
Yes, I knew you would. So then, how did we get to architectural procedures? We couldn't have gotten to them prior to having come upon architectural body. Okay? That's an interesting intrusive landing site, James. Stop. Whoa. I go on with this? I climb around this? Okay. Now.
Good.
Yeah. An architectural body. The body proper plus the architectural surround. That is the architectural body. We have trouble feeling our architectural bodies, sensing our architectural bodies, because our surrounds are so non-procedural, so dully constructed. Well, I'm not nervous. I'm waiting for the sound. The sound is pulling me to another universe. But, okay.
Can you go upstairs and ask them to stop?
Yeah, you already asked. But it is a big building. There are a lot of.
Okay, so we have invented a new type of architecture that we name procedural architecture. And we call it procedural architecture because it's based on architectural procedures. And in our book, Architectural Body, we name and describe two architectural procedures. You might remember we speak of the tentativeness cradling procedure and the dispersed to contrast procedure. What are we dispersing and what are we contrasting? Well, that brings us to another term of ours, which is landing sites. So, and actually, the landing sites were born when I stood on those paintings of Arakawa's. They were paintings for closed eyes. And I glanced at the paintings. They were diptychs, usually, or triptychs. And then I closed my eyes obediently. But I wanted to know these horizontal markings that were amazingly, oddly abstractions out into the world. And I wanted so to concentrate on them, but I wanted to obey what it said at the bottom of the canvas, which is, close your eyes. I stood there on the ramps, and I looked but didn't look but was suffused by what was there, and the word came to me body-wide, the word landing site or landing sites. And I thought, these are landing sites. These are landing sites. I am proportionately landing. What lands? We don't know. That something lands, we assert. Each one of us in this audience is producing configurations of landing sites. My voice is coming at you as oral landing sites. Your rears on the chairs are landing sites. And we define landing sites as any discernings whatsoever. And landing sites abound within landing sites. They occur on many different scales of action, and they abound within one another.
Right.
So when we speak of a disperse to contrast procedure, it's pretty simple. We have to juxtapose elements and features of an architectural surround that are similar to a certain extent so that they can draw the body. We have another word for body, too, but I'm not going to slow this down with that at this moment. Draw the body to produce, or we say really co-produce with biosleep, co-produce landing sites, now in one position and now in another position, in a similar enough manner that they can be, that these dispersions, these landing site configurations can be contrasted. Contrasted for what? Well, for what they potentiate us to be able to say and do. So let me stop there for the moment. Yes.
Winter, I met Martin Duchamp from the airport. I have no one to call. I'm a friend of mine. I gotta take this telephone number. So I called. I wrote, since 17 years old, I wrote 30 or 40 letters, one letter. He never wrote back to me, so I was quite angry. Jimmy Duchamp took the telephone. Are you Arakawa or the Arakawa or our Arakawa? I never understood this. I don't understand. I'm Arakawa. But anyway, he said, come over. We met under the Washington Square. He was alone December 28th. No one there. But anyway, he said, first day, hello, okay. I'm Arakawa. Arakawa. Are you Arakawa? And there's two fingers. Don't look at this. Don't think about this. At least twice or three times. I thought, what the is fucking going on? Past the day. Pushing like this. And I said, let's go. Dinner. He was thinking, wrong here, most interesting. With my broken English, I said, I like to be 20th century Leonardo da Vinci. And he said, which way? I like to construct nature. Nature means me. He looked at me, nature means you? Yes. Mountain, sky, the sky, name. Nature means place. And he looked at me. Friend, he said. And he never said anything else after that. And he ordered spaghetti without sauce. It was a weird thing, but anyway. 40 minutes later, left. They started helping me economically, very peculiar way. Sending every week very famous dealers coming and buying anything, diet, or anything at all. With some diet, with Japanese, they bought Kodesh and some bought something. I'm giving money anyway.
Before he died, he told Atambois in France,
once or both. He said, if I'm going to disappear, he never used God. If I disappear, can you make this kind of canal? And can you build your own small house, town? If you move, your room started to move, can you call Leonardo? That's where he died. That was quite, to me, one of the incredible impressions I had in 1971, to still have dreams. This one. You know, sometimes for me, hey, still you're too slow. But anyway,
so what was Leonardo missing?
Yeah.
He was missing biotopology and procedural architecture.
Yes.
What I'm kind of curious about is, for the last number of years, you've been talking about reversible destiny, mm-hmm. which I thought was the subject for this evening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And so I'd like to find out, among others, I think it's an exciting idea that you should talk about it, because as a general rule, death hasn't been that kind of a subject. As far as I can make out, that's to say, people have thought about immortality, but the idea that it would be a secular option—that's to say, that people have not merely the choice of living forever, which is presumably what reversible destiny amounts to. That it's something one can take. Steps toward, one can take measures, one can begin to do things to assure something like that should take place. And when people have that as an agenda, when people really do believe that there is that option, what do they do? What kind of research exactly do they do? Go into diet, for example. That is to say, if one eats a certain kind of thing, then death can be interminably postponed. Or I like to talk about architecture. If we live in houses of a certain kind, will we live forever? Is there a kind of architectural immortality that unfortunately we haven't found yet? But if we put our minds to it, we might.
What we need to do is we have to bring out into the open what goes on. We have to bring out into the open what goes on as an organism that persons. We are all organisms that person. We know that some organisms that person don't succeed in forming a person, but it seems that this assembled group, each of us has succeeded to some extent, but then we're going to croak. And what do we do about that? We look at, we open up this that we are. I mean, cancel the word observe, but I want to say observe. We observe within special surrounds what goes on as an organism that persons. Other people might speak of an organism that persons as a moving body and body movement. We just can't take anything for granted. And we can not only observe, we can simultaneously promote transformations. Here's a QED, okay? It's this vocabulary that has come our way through the years that we've come to rely on, that we desperately needed, and now we have landing sites. We have this dispersion of landing sites that I spoke of earlier. Well, each of us, each organism, that person, co-produces a configuration of landing sites, okay? That producing of landing sites also, in the course of producing a world, this gallery space, the people around all of us, also forms the producer or the co-producer as well. So you are to some extent formed by the landing sites that you disperse. Will you grant me that?
No.
All right. then ask the question. And why not, my dear?
Why not?
Maybe a way, another way of connecting the two questions or the two sides of the question, and also going back to what Araka was calling up Duchamp, it's this impression that I have looking at the models of your houses, that they are very beautiful. And so I know that this is not the aim, but it happens. And my question would be, is that part of the general project of a reversible destiny, which would mean living in the work of art, living in a house, in an architecture that would be like a work of art, and that would have at the same time the effect of transforming the body? Would you see this as a possibility?
There's a his famous epitaph, right?
Yes.
Pourtant,
d'ailleurs,
ce sont les autres qui meurent.
D'ailleurs, c'est toujours les autres qui meurent.
Yeah, that idea. So, it's true that while you're alive, the only people who die are other people, and so forth. So you tend to think that death is something that happens to others, but doesn't happen to you, and so forth. And I mean, it's kind of a in intriguing utterance for him to for that so to speak to be the epitaph over a corpse, you might say, Duchamp's corpse, that he is now the other in that kind of way. He is the one who dies in 1968, but as long as he was alive, that death was for other people, and so forth. But apart from finessing pronouns, what can you generate out of it? I mean, it's a brilliant, witty thing for Duchamp to have had carved on his tombstone. But what can you make out of it other than, I am dead is not an utterable a sentence. That is to say, you can say it, but it's never true as long as you're saying it. And I'm alive seems like some kind of a tautology. So if you say I'm not alive, then that in some ways self-stultify in the speaker's mouth. But those are just logical moves of a certain kind. That is to say, those are mysteries of the first person singular. Those are grammatical mysteries. Those are in a kind of way linguistic mysteries. But when one talks ordinarily about reversible destiny, one never talks ordinarily about reversible destiny.
One will soon.
The only time I talk about reversible destiny is when I'm with my friends, the Aragalis. But basically, if one does talk, one thinks one's not talking about grammar. One thinks one's really talking about biology in some way. That is to say, what we have to do is to reverse biology. And so, what steps are you taking?
All right, well, we have to then go back a little bit. We can go back by way of Duchamp, if you like, but maybe not. Well, let's go back to what you would not grant me. The landing sites. The landing sites. Landing sites abound on many scales of action at once, abound within each other, and occur on many different scales of action at once.
All right.
Okay? This is what we speak of as an approximative, rigorous abstraction. It just holds the place for what's going on as an organism that persons. It doesn't overreach. It doesn't overstate. Very much the way Duchamp didn't overstate on his tombstone. He handled what he could. That man knew how to travel light. That's why we admire him. Mm-hmm. Because the worst thing is to be sort of immersed in or suffused by one's own art. Okay, then the landing sites mark or hold the place for how we are dispersed in the world as organisms that person. Can you find some? Do you want to give me your term for that? Let's open up what we speak of as a terminological junction. We say landing sites. Don Ide says author says something else. There might be something. For example, I was saying to you, Don, that your notion of multi-stabilities seems to me a very promising candidate for landing site analysis. I'd like to get in there.
That's for landing site analysis.
Yes. Yes. Very much so. What?
Repeat that. I said Don's notion of multi-stabilities, which is similar to the rabbit and the duck, but it goes beyond that. Don will explain that, and then I will tell you why I think it's open.
Well, what I call post-phenomenology, while it derives from the phenomenological tradition, comes to a somewhat different conclusion than classical phenomenology. In classical phenomenology, what you do is you apply what is called variational theory to various phenomena, and Husserl, in the early days at least, hoped that this would yield some sort of essence. And I have incorporated a sort of more radical version of variational theory into my analysis, particularly of technological objects, technological materialities, etc., but earlier into visual illusions and things of that sort. And what I discovered was that when you apply this notion of variations rigorously, you come out with a series of what I call multistabilities. There's no essence. There are, in other words, different kinds of stabilities that occur. Now, I'm going to give you a very, very quick example of a material rather than a conceptual or visual illusion one. One of the interesting things about humans is that almost every society has invented archery, or let's just call it bow under tension. I call it the seventh machine because the Greeks didn't exploit this. They had their six machines, etc., but the seventh machine is a bow under tension. And what's interesting about this is that each culture adapts this in a somewhat different way. So that, for example, very quickly, the English longbow is a long 6-foot bow which is fired by infantry, can be fired very fast. The technique is you hold the bow out here, you pull it, let it, the arrow go like this. If you're good, you can get 5 arrows in the air before the first one hits the ground, etc. The Mongolian invaders, roughly around the same time, did their bow work on the back of a horse. And they had to fire in according to just where the gait of the horse was. You couldn't have a 6-foot bow, so you have a radically recurved bow, and the technique is radically different. You hold the arrow, you push the bow out, let it fire this way, and you can also fire very fast. The Chinese invented a bow that was so hard to pull, it was a recurved bow, that you couldn't possibly either do this or this. You had to pull both at the same time, a sort of artillery bow. Now, there are other variations upon this, and I'm saying that these are different stabilities of this trajectory, but you don't stop there. Mm. Anybody who ever fired a bow, and I do archery myself, can hear "bang" when you fire the bow, and so it turns out that African Bushmen play the bow when they go on their marches. Ding, bang, 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 bang. And there are variations. First of all, you put a little gourd resonator on it. Sometimes you take a second bow, etc. And I've been able to dig up stuff that goes back to Bushman cave paintings 2500 before present. In Trafford, France, there's a shaman who's playing the bow this way, 15,000 years BP. So here's another trajectory and another stability of development. And so your stringed instruments come out of the same bow under tension, etc. You don't stop there. You twist the bowstring, you make a fire stick, or you change the friction fire stick and put a drill on it, you have a drill, or you change the string and you make it into a saw and you have a bow saw, etc. So here you have three archery trajectory, a musical instrument trajectory, a tool trajectory, all from the same basic kind of thing. And each one of these corresponds to a different kind of context, a different kind of cultural situation. That's, in a nutshell, the notion of multistability.
All right, so I was thinking that this would be an interesting to look at each instance, each stability of a trajectory, and see the landing sites of which it consists, to look at a micro version and a macro version. Basically, what Arkal and I are now at the point of insisting on for our new science, which goes along with our new architecture, which, as you know, we've named biotopology, is the taking into consideration of as many scales of action that occur at once as possible. Okay? So when you look at a stability, if you go down and up to the different scales of action which sort of stabilize it, that might be of interest, and it might make a bridge between what we're doing and what you're doing. And these bridges we name terminological junctions. For example, we speak of one. I'll give you an example of a terminological junction. That would be, we speak of the organizing principles of an organism, that person, certain organizing principles that also organize the stabilities, organizing principles, but we also might speak of them as allowing tendencies. And we also might speak of allowing tendencies as axes of possibility. So that's a terminological junction. We open up, instead of roping ourselves or getting caught up in one way of putting something, we sidle up to it, we open it, we present it, and we come at it from a slightly different angle and try to hold it. So some things that we've come at, you know, through our need, and anything Arkal and I have invented is from totally desperate need. Okay, as you know, from the day we met, we have decided not to die. And we want to save our skins, and we cannot save our skins without saving all of yours, too. So it has to be communal, and we have these desperate needs. So when I talked about landing sites, you know, it's something that we had to assert. We had to insist that this mic is there. That's all we wanted to assert. We didn't want to talk too much about what that mic is, but we wanted to assert a position for something that was so-called perceived. But we didn't want to even go into perception, because that's a whole other difficulty. So we held a place, what others speak of as perception, but we more than held a place. We noted a place. We noted a site. And that was landing sites. Okay, so now I'm wondering, you're familiar with our term landing site, author. I wonder, when you read landing site, what occurs to you? And Don, too, I have the same question for you. When you hear Arkal and me speak of landing sites, what are you thinking?
I think it's a metaphor for something. And then I have to try and figure out what. So it always seems to me that when you talk about landing sites, mm-hmm. you're talking about some mode of perception. Mm-hmm. And why you want to say landing site is a picturesque way of saying mode of perception. And then there are different landing sites, so there are different modes of perception. The traditional five senses.
Yes, now remember what I said, Arthur.
So why exactly?
We want to open it. Perception closes it, and it's a word, and it comes in clunk. We want to open it. We want to open it, and we want to have a sense, just as I said before, of biosleep. We want a set of dynamics. Each of these terms, which are approximative, rigorous abstractions, hold open a set of dynamics. And then we don't name into it any further until it comes to us. We proceed. Otherwise, you know, our race, you know, just sits around and pens texts and croaks. So we think that a more loose type of naming, rigorous but also somewhat approximative, can set us free from this verbal nightmare.
Arthur, this landing site, when we met you at 70, we had the place from here, not so far, Krotenhausen. We are studying infant. But 2 months old kid or 3 months old infant, 100 of them. When mother went bring like this, kids crying like this, especially a room when brought, then at the moment stop. Then I told this mother, can you bring other infant? Few of them. We started study this way, couple of years. Then we found out what a crazy. I was almost infant movement is like image itself for me. First time, other artists, I thought, my God, image is a strange thing. Multiple bios creep, multi-dimensional movement without movement, any movement. Image does not exist in this world, as I found out, somehow, conceptually. So I thought, must be totally topological, where kids move. And most strange way, they stop. Mother, father cannot control at all. But weird event, stop. So I thought, more we study, we don't have a language to describe what's going on. Millions, billions of different kind of image, the one making movement. From that moment, we started Helen Keller's life completed together. So Helen Keller started to move just like infant. Hello, mother, like that. I thought, what's going on? We all have that power, but we never use it. That means to say we are not the five senses of ten. We have a million senses we have. We can look with other eye. We can look at. I can look at back with this action. That means to say all given in this world, light, temperature, anything we can make it ourselves. Any phenomenon, this organism can make, can construct. Think about this. When you're losing a little bit of balance, what do you, we're doing alone? What are you talking? How you? What's going on there? Gravity, we can make. Not God made, this universe made it. Newton knows quite well. I studied a little bit Newton. That's why he went, maybe we can construct life, like I thought.
You know, there's that thought in Heidegger, when he talks about authenticity, that a person begins to live authentically.
Yeah.
When he realizes that, as a matter of fact, death was something that happens to him or could happen to him. Mm. That except and until that recognition comes, that contrary to Duchamp, death is not only for other people, it's for me, then I'm leading an inauthentic life.
Mm-hmm.
That is supposed to be at least one of the deep thoughts that Martin Heidegger had. And so forth. So that maybe in getting rid of death, you're getting rid of a certain kind of authenticity. That it's not, as it were, the picnic that it sounds like it must be when you begin to talk about, oh, I'll live forever.
Mm.
Well, wait a minute here. First of all, Heidegger, like all of our predecessors, was insufficiently architecturally guided and supported. So he did the best he could. He winged it, like billions of others before us. So we have to, as I said before, open up the terms. So Arkha had this strong realization that imaging is a function of bodily movement, you know. But then I reminded him, and I always have to remind him, or he has to remind me, that we don't want to say imaging. I mean, nobody knows what imaging is. We don't know how we image. We don't know what we are as organisms, as persons, and we don't know how we image. So let's just break it down to the landing sites. Let's have imaging landing sites. Let's have perceptual landing sites. And then for good measure, let's throw in dimensionalizing landing sites, which is a hybrid between imaging and perceptual landing sites. Okay, those are the landing sites. So now, instead of speaking of body and body movement, we want to speak of organism that persons. All right, forget the body. Now we're talking about organism that persons. That's our subject matter. That will be our subject matter until reversible destiny shall have been achieved and beyond. Organism that persons, and so we had body and body movement. Then we say organism that persons and an intermixture of different scales of action, event, and displacement. That's a lot to handle all at once, okay? But we have now this science, which I can read you a few. Should I read a few of these things about biotopology, just to refresh your memory? I'm sure it's in Making Dying Illegal, let's see. In addition to being thought of as an area of knowing that utilizes plenty of unknowing, biotopology can be thought of as an area of self-saving cognizing, one that scrambles for points of view as well as straddling points of view or landing between them. Biotopologists prefer to err on the side of having too many points of view. Biotopology does away with discrete objects and thus with boundary conditions altogether. I'm talking about biosleeve. Should I go on? Or?
Yeah.
Biotopologists recognize and maintain that any segment in operation due to mass energy takes place on many different scales of action at once. Will you grant me that?
I have to read it over.
Cautious.
I wouldn't
cautious,
sign my
cautious,
name too
much. Cautious author. If your life depended on it.
Yeah.
Let's see. This one I think you'll say yes to. Okay. Any focused upon scale of action gives every appearance of existing in isolation, but this is far from what prevails. It might, in any event, and for a start, be noted that an initial difference in scale exists between the level or scale of action that is being focused upon and that within and through which the focusing upon is occurring. The focusing in question subsumes or consists of both these scales of action at once, along with many others as well.
I have to throw a little Heidegger trivia into this. There's a very, very nice little book that came out this last year by Adam Schaff called Heidegger's Hut. As most of you know, probably he had this little bitty hut in Todtnauberg, as well as a suburban house in Freiburg. Both of the locations were largely chosen because they were cheap, and the design of the architecture was done by his wife, with the exception of the study, which he insisted in the Freiburg house be the biggest room in the house. But that's his architectural poverty, if you will. I think I'd want to amend. I mean, when I used to be fonder of Heidegger than I am now, and I'm not very fond of him at all these days, I thought being towards death was rather interesting.
You what? I'm sorry, Bob. You what?
I'm not very fond of him these days.
No, okay. I've never been very fond of him, but still.
But one of the interesting things about Heidegger's time notion, which I think a lot of people miss, is that whereas authenticity is grounded in this being towards death and the recognition and acceptance of one's ultimate death, futurity is the primary ecstasis of Heidegger's time theory. But what this really means is, as we project into the future and gather up the past, the present is the last to arrive. But the implication that most people miss is that if that is the case, the past changes or can change. And this is, I think, one of the most radical consequences of Heideggerian time theory. And interestingly enough, that may map in certain ways.
It might. We had a nice dance with Heidegger for several years when we were in our blank period.
Yes, I do.
I think it was, what is it? Discussion on a Country Road, or Dialogue on a Country. Yeah, that was very blankful, wasn't it? That work. Yeah.
By the way, just from here, Heidenberg asked me about blank. I said, artist, say blank. What philosopher say, use it? Nothing. And I said, how about scientist? He asked me. And I said, vacuum. And he laughed at that. That's interesting. That means extraordinary energy within the nothing and blank? Yes. And he laughed. And he never said anything. That means to say, since 17th century, we use language depend on what you have profession. Totally different meaning. Not 360 degree, million degree different. No wonder all science, philosophy, and art went the wrong way. We never care about this, what we have. That means to say we have no idea about life means. Not one single people know on this planet. But still, I said, I'm dying. I'm living. I'm something. This idiotic conversation going on. We made billions stupid story. We have to put all into the garbage, this one.
But we can now put us, we can put an organism and a person within a procedurally designed architectural surround, and we can see what that organism and that person produces. Because an architectural procedure invites sequences of actions. And those actions are revealing of the basic capabilities of human beings. So, I could return to that landing site thing, because that's where it is, Arthur. It's very direct. It's very simple. So, I mean, if you're not going to help me open up the terminological junction, I'll do it for you. You would probably like to say perceptual trajectories.
I'd love to say it.
Maybe since we also want this conversation to be open to the public, and obviously there's a longer conversation that has gone on for many years. So maybe some of you have questions about terms, for instance, definitions. So please, if anybody wants to ask a question, don't hesitate. Yes, Ben?
Supposedly you go to your landing site. How does that stop us from dying?
Terrific question. I have to do it specifically, I think, architectural procedure by architectural procedure. So let's take the tentativeness cradling procedure. I mean, it's really painstaking work to produce these architectural procedures. But we have now retraced our steps and written a text, which is part of our new book, Making Dying Illegal, which instructs others in the invention and assembly of architectural procedures. So if this starts getting going communally, we'll be far better off. It has to be a communal effort. Anyway, reversible destiny. But let's take tentativeness cradling procedure, okay? We juxtapose elements and features of the architectural surround so that when you are in this architectural surround, it invites you to become far more tentative than you are at this moment in this coffin-like space. Okay? You're not so sure of yourself. You're not so sure of where you are, and you're not so sure of where you're landing. Okay? And also, you have become a biotopologist, and you know to take into consideration as many scales of action as occur as once as possible altogether. So this tentativeness, we believe, will bring you back to, will bring you forward to a certain generative power that eludes you or that is covered over by your having been led all your life into one convention after another, into a conventionalized society that believes it's going to, that believes that we're all mortal. That's the answer.
Other questions?
I can add that one. See, you're asking landing site?
She's asking how it leads to not dying.
Oh, not dying. Mm-hmm. Just think about your own boys just in this room. How they're landing. To where? And how many? And what got to do certain your voice landed within the time. Strange communal condition you're making. Just speak. Your own voice. And when you're acting with voice, it's totally different to landing. And we never say goodbye to. You have no time to say. Partially you made this voice. And somewhere so-called blank, hanging on, your own voice. Sometime, year later, if you have special equipment, I can hear my own voice. Starting when where you move. A year ago, a big fight with my father, this in this room, just in the kitchen, and I hear my own voice. Why? No one started this kind of event. Not in the silence.
Good question.
Well, I just want to say I'm very interested in what you have to say. I'm very open to the project, but I'm not myself familiar with your work, the history of your work. And I'm fairly sure that there are other people in the room that aren't as well, so forgive my ignorance. But I'm just wondering exactly what, aside from a purely, let's just say, biological act of self-annihilation of the individual, what aside from that you think death is? Because it's not clear to me why any sort of project of, like, preventing dying as, like, an individual, you know, even if you say, okay, but it's a social effort, it's a collective effort to do this. I mean, not everyone lives in a world where, you know, if we do die, we die incidentally, you know, just at the end of, you know, some sort of process of aging with our families around our bed. Like, I mean, I don't understand. What does this mean? You're going to eliminate global famine or global, you know, I mean, I just don't, death is, doesn't seem like this sort of incidental
thing. Have you ever seen anyone die?
Yeah, actually,
I will give you this one.
Thanks. I saw a man fall off of scaffolding area, actually around the time I moved to New York, which is alarming. But so if someone, you know, let's say we grant a purely individual, you know, arena, if we're talking about dying, you know, I mean, are you saying that your sort of biological approach, if this guy fell off the scaffolding, he would survive? And then on a truly
No, we're not saying that.
Yeah, okay.
We're not saying that.
I say yes, possible.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Well, here's someone who can answer that too.
Yeah, but I think actually something that's a little bit missing from what I'm hearing now is the possibility of a person being put in various different challenging physical situations, probably outside of their control, like somebody falling on scaffolding, where they have to make a series of decisions based upon attempting not to die, even if they begin to die. And to your interesting question of what is dying, I discovered through an experience of my own that it's a process also. And it's a process, even if you, for example, in this age of war and uncertainty, people are more often finding themselves in situations where they can actually choose not to die. And you have to go through a whole procedure in your mind. And I think that there is a choice, and I think that there are procedures, and I think that certain people are forced into that, and they, through what Madeline Alcala was talking about, can learn not to die in specific situations, certainly. And in general, that's something I'm still thinking about.
That's great, Blair.
She had an incredible car accident.
She has amazing evidence, and she's going to give a paper at the conference. I think I spoke to you about it. Mm-hmm.
There was another question.
I had a question.
Oh, not anymore. You haven't yet.
Your concept of multiple landing sites, is it that you're saying that you're projecting yourself out into multiple directions? So that what's left is a kind of presence that's immortal within your architectural space. I'm kind of confused in terms of how you arrive at this space that is no longer defined by.
We don't know the answer, and we don't know what landing sites are. We know what we have now judged to be worthy of trying, worth trying, but we do think that it probably would be more. Accurate to our existences, if we think of ourselves as architectural bodies. That we think if we have the basic unit for consideration B, as I said before, the body proper plus the architectural surround, but an architectural surround that is designed with a great deal of forethought.
Very good question. We don't have an answer yet this moment, but this since 17th century, let's take about this 300 years, we really, no one really focused this organism relation to all around. Why? Such a great equipment we have, more than any other computer. They cannot imitate this body, no matter how far we go. And every moment, we can invent how to use different way to use this body. When you look at just infant baby, just about these couple hours, just look at every angle, 3 months old baby, they are inventing unbelievable things. And they're inventing thousands of different signature sign language. What they want, what something. If they can hear, they can translate that language, we can go quite far. But we ignore. When they started a little language, already completely losing so many sense, thousands and thousands of sense disappearing. So just now, one of the most interesting things going on, Madeline and I, we built in Tokyo 9 apartments. Most of the poor people put money, 100 people, and we made this one. And now, about 6 families are living. One family with kids, 2-year-old kid, he changed within 9 months, changed the entire behavior. And now, parents want to watch television, this kid goes, and push the mother like this, come with me to walk. room.
Well, they asked him to do something. His name is Yuma. His name means truly playful. Yuma. And they asked him, Yuma, do this or that. And he said, let me reflect on that for a while.
Really, that's where. And when he go out, he take off all clothes. Totally. And mother and father said, don't. He said, take off. When he goes to junior high school, take off. And teacher calling, your son is terrible. Constantly take off clothes. Why that? If he take off all clothes, he's so sensitive, he said. Totally sensitive. And this moment, we are getting every week, getting better from him. 2 years saying this portrait without a head.
I could read this biological report about anything. I've been sharing about this opening that we're talking about. Opening and opening and dwelling on and opening. Okay? I'm going to deliver that.
I think one of the interesting things. The philosophers up here are worried about how metaphorical things are, obviously, compared to how literal they are. But one of the campaigns that Eric Hawangins are on is this making dying illegal. What this amounts to, whether it's metaphorical or literal, is a campaign for a kind of radical ethic. In which making dying illegal, were it to be adopted by civilized peoples, etc., would have a lot of interesting implications to it. I mean, obviously, volcanoes and hurricanes and tsunamis are going to occur regardless of whether you make it illegal or not. There are going to be accidents, etc., etc. But you raise the level of, what shall we say, awareness and responsibility for humans in solidarity and in community if you think in these particular terms. So I think one of the things that appeals to me about Eric Hawangins, setting aside for the moment the question of metaphors, is that this really is an interesting radical ethical, social ethical proposal.
Mm.
Look things up to see more. What a plant!
We'll give you a card after that.
Yes!
Call them landing sites.
Reversible destiny. Reversible destiny, yes.
Thank you.
See, one last question.
I was just wondering if you could explain or respond to or define something about the function or the use of agreement. What? How do you respond? What is? How do you think of agreement?
Agreement.
You could ask them.
It's an interesting question.
Yes, it is.
How do you think of agreement?
Go to it.
Well.
You want to elaborate on the question, kind of?
No.
I don't think I can answer. I need more. So it just doesn't sprout forth unless more comes.
Kate Grimm used to talk about agreement as
one question about agreement might be, how do we agree, and do we need to agree?
What?
How do we agree, and do we need to agree?
Sooner or later, I think we need to agree. Mm. That is to say, sooner or later, there's very little point in going on disagreeing.
Yeah.
So, like, for example, should we drive on the right or the left side of the street. Some decisions got to be made at some point.
Yes.
And very difficult to have and anything like a rational society if there weren't a great deal of consent. And that seems to me what agreeing really comes to is consent.
If success then is the cheapest form of censorship, right? And if Homeland Security can already charge you with crimes that you're not at liberty to commit, and if you can be deemed guilty of a crime which is yet to occur, maybe your own death, then
hi there.
What is the law that we are declaring release? What is the function of agreement? What is the function of disagreement?
Hi there.
We just wanted to highlight the fact that architecture is a great tool for helping the organism, the person, sort itself out. And for centuries, people have not gotten it, and we wonder why it's taking so long and how we can speed up history and give our poor benighted bodies, otherwise known as organisms and person, a chance to have quite a bit more time than the usual allotted number of years. And so that's why we thought it would be very useful, and I think Don Adi put it beautifully, very useful to declare dying illegal. Then we would all be responsible for one another's ongoingness.
Yeah, maybe I, as a Frenchman, I'm never averse to disagreeing, but I think we all agree that this was a very interesting discussion tonight. So thank you.
Thank you.
I'm amazed. What a crowd.
How old?